Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host, Austin Yeh. And Mayu is not with us today. He's actually traveling around the world in Australia. So this is going to be another awkward preamble because it's a little bit awkward when I'm speaking to myself. But we'll try my best to get through this. Couple of big news that came out. All eyes are really on the US in terms of data points and when rate cuts are going to happen, because of course, we know that data in Canada is favorable in the sense that our GDP is slowing down, unemployment is going up. It's sort of aligned with rates to come down. But the only thing that's holding us up is the U.S. performing extraordinarily strong. It's a tale of two economies, really. And with the U.S. being much stronger than Canada, it really puts Canada in a tough place, because what the argument is that we may not necessarily be able to cut rates as aggressively as we'd like, even though we as an economy are ready to, just because the US is still going to hold rates higher for longer. And if we do cut, then our dollar is going to continue to devalue, which could be inflationary in the long term. So there's that sort of argument that's being made. And the Fed on May 1st basically came out and said that inflation is not really moving the way that they would like. It's coming in hotter than expected. And so market was not really pricing in any cuts for the Feds. I believe maybe only one cut in December. The probability was continuing to slide over time. At the time of recording this preamble, there was actually some positive news on the US end. There's a gain of 175,000 payroll jobs. And that sounds like a lot, but it was much lower than the expectation that economists were having. And if it came up on the upside, meaning that it outperformed, that would obviously be devastating, because rates would definitely be higher for longer. But the fact that it came in materially lower is obviously a good thing. And on top of that, wage growth has slowed down in the US, came below analyst expectation, and unemployment rate increased higher than analyst expectations, which is a direction that we want to see in the US. And as a result of that, the US dollar fell, Canadian dollar climbed. It looks like the markets and traders are already betting that the Federal Reserve may cut rates sometime in September, followed by another quarter basis point cut in December. So both probabilities have increased on the basis of this news that came out today, which could be a positive sign for the Bank of Canada to continue to go forward with its rate cutting plans this year. Just important to note that the probability of a rate cut in June, from when I last checked, it was slightly above 50%. I'm sure with this news coming out, that probability has slid higher. So we are likely still looking at rate cuts in Canada in the summer. Hopefully we're getting as much as 3 or 4 this year, but we can only wait and see, right? It's all on a data by data basis. On my end, outside of that, I've been looking at purchasing my next either investment property or flip. Been looking at another market. Don't want to voice it out just yet until I'm a little bit more serious around the search, but been doing some analysis on another market, getting on calls with realtors, with other investors in that market, and looking to make the move sooner than later. As ideally, my criteria right now is that if I'm able to partially burn the property and be cash flow neutral or slightly positive, in my eyes, that's a win, because the rate environment is higher. So when the rates drop, then hopefully there'll be some more cash flow on these properties. And when I'm underwriting these deals, typically underwriting it on a variable rate, because ideally variable rates are going to go down over time. And if it, again, a cash flow positive or neutral on a variable rate, I can bank that over time. It's just going to be hundreds of dollars positive in 2 or 3 years down the line. Outside of that, the wholesaling business, we sent out a couple of deals. If you guys haven't checked it out, most definitely do so. A couple of vacant multifamily properties, single family flips. We have other sort of deals that we're working down in the pipeline. We've been sort of playing around with the different marketing strategies and getting unique with it, and it seems to be working. Obviously, don't want to dive deep into what we're doing, but it is leading to some results here. So expect some more deals to come out in the email list. Without further ado, we're just going to jump into today's episode. Today, we have Henry Rojas on. He's a phenomenal investor in the multifamily and development space. He started off not too long ago doing triplex conversions, but then moved on into a development project in St. Catharines. We get into some of the hurdles around that. He's been in the site plan approval process over the past 2 years, but hopefully about to wrap that up. So we go into the learning lessons on that, because of course there's a lot of obstacles when you make a big jump into the development space, and things that he's learned and considerations for other investors not to make the same mistake. He also helps other investors as well with planning around the development process. And so we get into some considerations and due diligence that investors should keep in mind when they're going to get into development. We get into conversions as well, because Henry is doing something interesting where he's taking things like 5-plexes, 6-plexes, 7-plexes, 8-plexes, and then using the exact same shell and adding additional units to the property. So instead of building an addition to these multifamilies, he's working within the shell of the property, which is much cheaper, and adding additional units into it, thus increasing NOI and the value of the building. We get into the analysis around that, how he's been able to successfully implement that, and how he's been able to help his clients implement that as well. Lastly, we touch on some amazing projects that he's working on now, such as the huge church conversion, as well as some other cool things in the pipeline. Don't want to ruin the episode for you, but definitely I got a lot of value from it. I know Mayu did as well. So if you guys enjoyed this episode, make sure to share with a friend, leave us a 5-star review. And without further ado, let's jump right on in. Just a heads up before we get started, this podcast is all about providing you information, not financial or legal advice. So if you need the real deal for your situation, hit up a professional. We can't promise you our information is always up to date or accurate, and we're not responsible for any investment decisions you make based on it. Markets change, information change, you know the drill. Anyways, thank you for hanging out with us responsibly. Let's jump right on in. Hello, everyone. We are joined with our very special guest, Henry Rojas. Henry, how's everything going?
It's going fantastic, buddy. Everything in the market is going crazy. So as long as we're keeping up, I'm enjoying every second of it.
For sure. And so for Henry, for everyone else that might not know you, why don't you give us a quick background on yourself, who you are, what you do, how you got into space. Your full life story in about like a minute.
Perfect. That's more than enough time. So started all my careers back in 2017, started with custom home design, realized pretty quick weren't my cup of tea, and decided to move on to more investor focused type of a group in terms of like doing duplex and apartment buildings in early 2018. Some of them with some investors who were focused in that sort of area, small and large is what we were working on as a side hustle. Until eventually I decided to do my own business back in late 2018, early 2019. So I've been in this space for the last 4 or 5 years, doing projects from like duplex, triplex, low rise and high rise apartment buildings, right? Because everyone's a little bit different in their strategies. So right now we're just helping our investors with a building permit process.
So you started off in the construction space, right? And I think it's always interesting because we have different people on from different areas of life, and everyone brings their own kind of unique advantage to the real estate world, right? So you started the construction business for yourself in 2018. You pivoted towards, I guess, more investor-focused like construction work, right? And I'm sure you've seen multiple markets kind of shift since then. But since 2018 to now, so I guess you also started accumulating real estate properties somewhere along the way.
Yes. So I bought my first property back in 2019, early 2020, a small single family in Welland area, south of St. Catharines. And right away, I'm just like, let's do a triplex. You know, everyone's doing duplex, just go triplex. And then that snowballed into multiple properties. But it's just trying to start off small and just scaling yourself up. It just takes a little bit of time.
So I guess when you were starting off, how did you get source of funds? Was it just through your business and saving? Because that seems to be a huge sticking point when people get started off, especially now. Because I know back in 2018, sort of that was around the period where we all sort of got started. You could get into the market with easily less than 6 figures, including renovation cost, down payment. Nowadays, you need multiple 6 figures to get into the market to do a BRRRR. So how was the financing structure looking like when you got started, the down payment, renovations, et cetera, et cetera?
No, 100%. So obviously, you know, I had my own savings accounts from years ago, right? I'm not very like, spending person, personality type of thing. I don't really need a lot of things to make myself happy. So it's just more of just trying to save as much as you can. But of course, back to your old point of like, it was a tough time back then as well. I of course tried to look within the GTA and Hamilton region at that time. And still it was outside my price range being like a sole person by myself. And I decided to just expand a little bit outwards just because it's a little bit more affordable. St. Catharines was a little bit okay. And then I found Welland, where a couple other investors and I kind of like found out and started buying properties. Well, they started buying property and I kind of followed suit just because the numbers seemed to make sense there. They were like, I bought that property for about 285, low 300, single family, 1500 square feet, detached. Wasn't too bad. It was in rough shape, but then it was the renovations and the knowledge I had from Talko and working with Simvers for so many years. I ran the numbers myself and try to see, you know, it's a lot of work, but we can still make it work with the numbers, right? So having that sort of connection really helped out understanding like what we can do, especially, you know, with that market at the time, we had to make a decision pretty fast. And yeah, no, that's how we kind of got started at that point.
And I guess in terms of the work that you were doing when you were getting started off, was it sweat equity or were you hiring things out? Because obviously you're a handyman.
I used to be a handyman, but I found out pretty quick I'm terrible with my hands. I do not enjoy the whole, you know, construction aspects of it. I understand it and I appreciate it. It just not really good with my hands, you know? So I was doing a little bit of sweat equity, of course, just because, you know, funds were tight. And then, yeah, I was hiring like sub trades, like the contractor, like the framing, electrical, plumbing, all that big fun stuff that I obviously can't do legally. But yeah, I was doing a lot of the finishing touches, like the flooring, the paint, the trim work, the doors. Some of that fun stuff there. So you really, when you're trying to get started, you really have to kind of balance out. Do you want to spend the extra money or can you do it yourself? I heavily suggest if you're handy, you're going to get pretty far when you start out versus someone like me who's like, doesn't really appreciate the handy work too much. Like I can't really, I'm not really handy, let's say. So, but I had to do what I had to do to get started. So we got to do things that we need to do.
And really, let me ask you this, because I'm always curious because I get completely like, you hear about people that will do a conversion for like 50, 60 grand. And then you hear about people that spend 180 grand in conversion, right? So, and this would be with my clients. So I'm like, I don't know, man. Like maybe that sounds like a little bit high of a number, but I don't know what's actually going on here, right? So what, like give me a ballpark number on the cost savings if you were to try and do majority of the general work yourself. So like call it like drywall, maybe not drywall, like paint, flooring, like stuff like that yourself, right? And then you're outsourcing certain functions. Like, what's the lowest that you think someone that's handy can do a conversion on their own?
Okay, so let's break it down. Like, let's reverse engineer this a little bit. So the average number we're seeing, like a 500, 700 square feet basement apartment into a unit, legalizing it properly is like anywhere between 80 to 120,000, give or take in the area. It's a big range, but again, there's so many different like tiers to it. So we'll just give it that range. And from that, I would safely assume about 20 to 30% you can do on your own, like the finishing touches. Anybody can buy an IKEA kitchen and sublet themselves. Anybody can install like the trim work, the doors, the paints, the floor. A lot of it's like the finishing touches. Of course, like the framing you can do yourself. It's just the specialized nicks. It's a little bit complicated, like the plaster, right? That's a little bit specialized trade that you don't want to really mess around with, right? Of course, the rough-ins, HVAC, mechanical, plumbing, all that stuff has to be done by somebody licensed. Right. So just to answer your question there, I would say whatever your number is, like you get a quote from a contractor, it comes out 120,000. I would safely assume about 20, 30% of it, you can do yourself. So that would be like that's a go-to number. But then at the same time, if I'm saving 30% of that funds, am I really saving that much if I can do it myself? Or am I better suited to do something I'm more specialized in, right? To get more deals. Like some people love to run the numbers, love to talk to other people, love to get the next deal. So is it worth saving 30%? To do that work myself over the weekend, or if it's like 2 hours away, is it worth doing that versus finding the next deal? You have to weigh your pros and cons. But as a startup, that might be your only route to go with.
Okay. And I sort of want to definitely get into some of the bigger stuff, but we want to lay the picture of how you've gotten involved in some of these bigger projects. So when you were doing these conversions, sounds like you were GCing, you were hiring all of these like sub trades. That being said, did you still find yourself driving back and forth pretty frequently to see progress, or were you able to manage things hands off?
No, I honestly, I'm kind of nitpicky myself as a personality. So I had to drive there every few days. Running my business and managing these guys at the same time wasn't really healthy at that time. And again, just because you hire a general contractor to kind of take care of all that stuff, right? So you only have one source of person, one contact to discuss with about everything. Versus if you're doing it yourself, you have to schedule everybody in. You have to see if they're actually there. Do you have some sort of program that everybody can sign up for and then show you progress pictures of it, right? It's all about, and also trust factor too. Like if they're your GC from a different city and you work with them before, maybe there's more of a trust building there. They can rely on them. Maybe you don't have to go every 3 or 4 days. You can go every weekend, for example. Or if it's like a brand new city that you can only afford in and you've never worked in a contractor in that city, now you have to kind of, you're a little bit anxious. It's like, you know, you don't know if work got done that day, right? You'll call them and they'll say, oh yeah, we did A, B, C, D, but then the pictures don't really prove that.
Right.
There's that sort of like balance there, which again, this is why we have networking events too. We connect with people, we talk with other agents or other investors about they work in that area and who they recommend to from a personal experience, not from like a Google review.
Yeah. And that's a good point. The reason why I asked that is because so many investors talk about outsourcing, which is extremely important, but sometimes they over outsource and gain too much trust. So they're like, oh, we're just going to get a virtual assistant to call all of these people, ask for photos and videos. Like, dude, I don't know if you're taking on a triplex conversion, like a substantial project, not just paint and flooring, but something substantial. I would want someone, to your point, that's on site, right? That's actually looking to make sure people show up and get the work done. It's a good thing that people are focused towards outsourcing, but I think we've hit that point where it's like they put too much trust in their virtual assistants to just handle every single aspect of their business. So it's good to hear that. Although you were sort of GCing, you still had to show up there.
Yeah, and again, it's just more of a trust thing. I've been burned before by their contractors, you know, their habits and their process and the way they thought of. And I used to be a construction project manager myself, so I know these guys day in, day out type of thing. So I know their habits. And again, they can be the nicest guy to start, but then their work habits or work ethics don't really follow suit. So you really got to be careful with that. Unless, again, they're very focused in the city that they're working in. They're a heavily investor-focused contractor that works with other investors in the area that are not really going to screw you around. So unless they're like that level of contractor, really, it's a trust thing at that point.
And so you guys go from there to ultimately getting into the multifamily space, right? So like around what time was the transition from the conversions and call it smaller multis into some of these larger multifamily buildings?
I would say it was probably the following year that Atok and I started looking into like a development in St. Catharines. So our
Brand
team is...
Development or you moved into existing multifamily?
Well, so we went into the land development first, and well, we were always working with like existing buildings with our own investors.
Right.
But for ourselves and our team, we just bought, you know, land development there and started working on the site plan approval phase for that building. Got it. Was an existing fiveplex on the corner lots. It had a parking lot beside it. We decided to like, you know, either flip it, renovate it and like hold, or like just do a new development, which again, it being our first project in all and being confident as we are doing what we're doing on a daily basis, we decided to take that route and do some sort of development on that space. Right.
Gotcha.
So that's how we kind of get started.
2020.
Yeah. This is like early, well, late 2020, I think early 2021, if I recall, is in between those 2 years, between the closing dates and when we got started and our final decision.
Okay, cool. So what did you guys end up doing? What happened with that deal?
We are still in site plan approval. St. Catharines is no joke. It's if you hear St. Catharines and investors, just run. Just no. It's not even funny at that point. It's like what we were expecting about a year, 18 months, and now it's going over a little over 2 years now. It's just a tough city to work with, honestly. It's the consultants, it's like everyone involved in there trying to make sure everyone is happy with the design and the development there. It's a little bit tough. And this is before Bill 23, which, you know, if you guys are familiar with Bill 23, any 10 units or below, you don't need site plan approval, but we already submitted it and we were like 95% there. Now for the last 5%, we're just waiting to hear back from the city. So it is a sort of like, you know, do we just take the chance to cancel the application and redo it, or do we just wait it out? Right. That's our struggle right now. But that's our land development project there. But simultaneously, while that's already still in the works, because we haven't done any rentals. We've been holding it for like 2 years. We decided to do some other projects on the side as well. So it's not like we stop our business just for this.
Right. So the difference between site plan approval and if you're going for a 10 unit building or a 9 unit building, right? What is that materially? What is the difference in process? Right. Because I think we all know that, okay, SBA 10 units and is it 10 units and above or above 10 units? Either one.
So, yeah. If you have exactly 10 units, you're safe. Once you hit 11 units, then that's when you need site plan approval. That being said, we've had some projects already approved that are over 10 units, but we weren't affecting any exterior work. So the city is like, okay, you know what? You're not touching anything outside. You're fine. Keep going. You pass site plan approval. So, but that's more of an interpretation between cities. It's like, if I present to them a project and trying to argue the fact that it's not, you know, it's more of a debate at that point, whoever wins at that struggle, right? But in order for them to properly analyze that, they have to review the drawings, right?
Help us understand what is site plan approval, right? So like, what does that actually mean, right? So if we're trying to build a 15-unit building versus an 8-unit building, what is the incremental amount of work? I know there's a site plan application. I believe there's certain like surveys and tree studies and stuff like that that's required if it's SBA, but I'd love to hear from you. So you go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because we're already doing a couple of them right now over Ontario. And the whole principle of it is that we're trying to show a design that either meets or doesn't meet zoning bylaws, depending on what you're looking for. And the city will review it and then let you know exactly what they're looking for in terms of like any sort of heritage value, if it's an existing building. For this example, it's called an existing building, just because a lot of people want to add density to their buildings. There's heritage study, there's parking study, there's like archaeological study. There's all these different consultants involved, like arborists and landscaping, that want to evaluate the lot of the building, not just the building itself, the actual lot, and see whatever you're doing is going to affect any of these elements or features. If it doesn't negatively affect it, then you have that pass, that check mark. If it does, they want proof to see, okay, you're saying you're not going to touch heritage, but we want an actual heritage report. I believe they call it cultural heritage assessment. I believe that's what they call it. And they want it to be done by somebody professionally done in that industry, which is now, you can imagine, it's another $20,000 for this consultant to say, yeah, you're not touching the heritage, you're fine, right? Okay. So it's all these different consultants we have to work with. It's much more than if you had done like a normal building permit. Thousands of dollars spent just to prove to the city that we're not doing anything extreme, and like 6 to a year like process, right? Mm-hmm. So you could be doing a project as simple as like just keeping it existing and splitting off some units, but now you have to go through all the site plan approval phase to prove to them that we're not doing anything that negatively affects the lot itself or the city's right. like system itself, right? So it's just all these little headaches and things you have to consider there, which is like twice or if not three times as hard as doing the building permit phase. Because building permit phase is like maybe I work with 3 or 4 different consultants. Site plan approval, we're working with like 7 or 8, okay. right? And we have to make sure everyone's happy. So it's our team plus our 8 consultants against the city and their 8 consultants at that point. So we're working with like almost 20 people trying to make sure everyone's on the same page.
So if you're going for 9 units, you are getting renderings done by your architect. You are then submitting them to the city with like the floor plans and the exterior drawings and everything like that. And it's just going to the planning department, I'm assuming, because if there's no zoning amendment and stuff like that that's needed, right? Then it would just be going to the planning department. And if they sign off on it, you guys are good to go. Is it that simple?
So some cities have a zoning review process. Some cities don't. If they don't have a zoning review process, you can go immediately for building permits, right? So there are some cities that you can just go for building permit, but then they'll still review the zoning. It'll be at that time. Some cities like Hamilton, where they have a zoning review process before you go into the building permit, just to see if there's any variance we have to go through or any site plan approvals or heritage or conservations. They'll list it out for you, right? It's safer to go that route, get a zoning check before you even start all the engineering work, right? Because based on that review, you might have to redesign your entire building because it doesn't meet A, B, or C, right? So it's always safe to go through zoning first.
Interesting. I didn't need to dig it on a tangent. Awesome. Glad it's inside of you.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to actually touch on it. It's a very interesting point that you mentioned there. A site plan approval obviously seems like a time-consuming process and fairly high risk to go through that, right? To get exactly what you want out of it. That being said, what sort of due diligence do you do beforehand to mitigate this risk? And secondly, when you mentioned that St. Catharines is very difficult to work with, what type of pushbacks and concrete, like this is a real life example that you're going through, what type of concrete pushbacks have they given to you that you weren't expecting? And were there any learning lessons along the way with that project?
Right, 100%. So let's start with the first question about due diligence. Yeah, so how it usually works with my team is that you're looking for a building to buy or do some development. We'll look into the zoning bylaws, the official plans, and any secondary plans involved with that city, seeing what they're looking to do in that area. What's allowed by zoning, but also what's part of the whole official plans for the next 5-10 years, right? Does it meet their actual plan for that? Or are we going outside their plans and now we have to get like either a zoning amendment, site plan approval, or whichever the case is, you might need some extra work there. So right away, we're telling the investors, hey, listen, you want to do 20 unit new development here? Here are like ABC risk. Or here's option 2. You do like 9 units or 10 unit development, you have less risk, right? What's the best for ROI? What's the highest and best use for that lot that meets your investment strategy, right? Everyone's a little bit different. Some people can actually have a bigger risk to do that bigger project. And some people just want to get started and doesn't want to take that much of a risk, even though they're putting money on the table, right? So that's why we help them understand that process. The next part of your question there regarding the whole St. Catharines issue, there was a lot of pushback, at least in our experience there, with the development and size of the project, where we were looking at like a low rise, like a single family neighborhood. And we were planning to do like a massive apartment building, 12, 15 units, 4 stories high. And they wouldn't accept that because, of course, it doesn't meet the neighborhood features, right? It's like a massive building in like a small, low density area. It was going to kill the vibe in that area. Basically, if I want to sum that up, right? That being said, it's like not that far away from other smaller developments. So in our case, when we were looking into that, we did thought it would look out of character, but with the city growing the way it was, we were confident that we would get at least some sort of relief from that. So of course, again, our assumptions and based what the city wants at this time, it didn't really meet their needs. But since we're almost there at that point, and again, after 2 years of negotiating and kind of compromising with our design, we've shrunk it down to about 3 stories, 12 units. So again, they didn't really say no to the entire process, but again, we had to push back a little bit on the size, unit types, right? Because originally we had like all 1 bedrooms. Now we have to have mixed use. You know, when I say mixed use, I mean like what, bachelors and 2 bedrooms, just right, to make sure we're flooding the market with different like unit types, not just like 1 unit type. Okay. But yeah, those are the biggest pushbacks we got from that experience.
Interesting. Okay, so do we want to sort of move on to some of the other projects that you're working on? Because I know like this one.
I know we went on a rabbit hole there, but so you know, going from your conversion to multifamily, and it was essentially a 1 year kind of like timeline there, right? Like 2020, you did a, was it 2020? No, 2019 or so, you did a conversion. 2020 at the end of it, 2021 early, you guys started this multifamily project. Where do you guys go from there? How did you, you know, take down these bigger buildings? You guys GPLP it, or are you guys self-funding? How do you go about that? Give us the story there.
Yeah. So at the moment right now, that's one of our biggest projects as a group there. But, and again, because of our bad experience in that, we were pushing more into like keeping the existing families and working with existing buildings, development there, right? And our whole main model right now is actually just taking apartment buildings and splitting up the units to add more density into that building show, right? The land development, we might play around with later down the road, but for now, we are exploring more of the existing buildings because they are easier to work with, faster turnarounds, and it just, everything's already there. So we're not spending as much on construction as we would have for a brand new land development, right? That's mostly our strategy at that point, which again, our main model is helping out with other investors who are at that level as well, looking to buy buildings or massive, I would say, mansions, and try to add as many units as we can. Obviously meeting zoning bylaws and trying to avoid site plan approval, minor variants and committee of adjustments.
Are these properties, like, is there like a concrete example that we can talk about? Let's talk about an existing multi that you buy. It sounds like not only are you adding units to, let's say, a basement or an addition, you're actually chopping up the existing layout and like, just redoing.
Yeah. So then like one project I can really talk about, because Talk and I just finished maybe last summer, is we had a 12-unit apartment building in Welland. And what we decided to do was split off a lot of the 2-bedroom units inside that building. So we converted that from a 12-unit building to like a 17-unit at the end of the day. So we split off a lot of the 2 bedrooms to create new 1 bedrooms and bachelors, adding more density in the existing building shell. And again, this is Welland. So we all know Welland's like pro like developments, and there wasn't too much pushback in that experience versus like the St. Catharines. We were about like less than 6 months to get from start to finish on permits. So that was a pretty quick turnaround there. And in construction took about 8 to 12 months, give or take, right? So that process altogether, it was probably the easiest way to kind of increase it, the value of that building versus just like some investors, again, have reached out to me to say, let's do an addition to the building. Let's build a brand new, smaller, like 3-story building beside it. We can add more units to that, but the construction cost doesn't make sense to do that much work for maybe 5 more units. So we like to work with the building shell and just increase density that way. Now, a lot of their investors were looking to actually see if they can buy older buildings built in like the 70s, 80s, that these massive like 3-bedroom, massive 2-bedroom units that we can easily divide up and add more units to it.
Do these properties need to be vacant upon possession? And if not, and you go through the N13 route, is the LTB going to be concerned that it's displacing like 10, 12, 13 tenants? Because we know that it's very lean towards tenant-friendly laws. So I can almost imagine them saying, no, we're not going to allow you to evict them.
Yeah. So how the permit process works is that nobody has to kind of leave the building for us to do the permit work, right? That being said, when we're looking for buildings, we're looking for at least 1 or 2 vacancies just so we can get the ball rolling. So for example, in their building we're working on, they have only 1 unit vacant, massive 3 bedrooms. And the argument was, do we just rent it out now and then do the developments and drawings now for that process? Or do we just, you know, wait out the 2 months to get the drawings in order to submit for permits? And we finally decided that we're just going to get the drawings ready and submit for permits. Waited 2 months because it's hard to get people out afterwards. It's like one more headache that even though you're making income for 2 months, it doesn't make sense in terms of value. So our process is, even if the building is completely tenanted, we can still do the drawings there. Now, it might raise questions with the tenants in their own little community in that building. But at the end of the day, you're not breaking any sort of laws there. We're just applying for permits. So then once one tenant leaves, again, naturally leaves, right? Or, you know, whatever cash for keys sort of method, then yeah, then we can start renovation on that unit specifically. Now, there will be common elements that we have to renovate, right? There are, like, let's say, for example, our strategy is to do a lot of these in-suite laundry service. Now, if we put an in-suite laundry service on the top floor, we have to run the drain all the way down, which interferes with other tenants in their units. We design it in a way that's going to be hidden inside a closet or inside of a various corner of the unit, so it doesn't interfere with them too much, but it's still work in their unit that they don't appreciate at the end of the day, but we still have to get it done to service that new laundry room that we already have permits for. So they really can't say no to that. Now, what they think afterwards, maybe they don't like the construction noise. They don't like the way the building's going about that. Some people leave on their own. Some people make a complaint. Some people stay there longer. Just depends on the building itself. We've seen it all different ways, right? Some of our buildings, a lot of the people just left after maybe a year of construction just because they couldn't handle the noise. And we're not doing that like in bad faith. We're doing our construction work as best we can following the laws. And if they just can't handle that, again, we're trying to make sure we're meeting our investors' like timelines there.
So hold on, sorry, I'm just a little bit confused there. So when you guys buy an existing 10-unit building, or I think your example was 12 units, and then you're making into 17. So you're taking, what is that, about three of them out, and you're adding about eight units in, roughly speaking?
Yeah, so in that specific case, I think we had four units, and we, you know, again, we didn't kick them out. Two of them were vacant, two of them left on their own after the renovation process was in the works. But yeah, as soon as they get vacant, we start renovating them and just splitting off the units itself. Because if one tenant leaves a two-bedroom unit, well, great, then we can split it off and make two units from that one unit.
Right. And could you not just evict them because you're going to be demolishing their existing unit, and then there's no right of return for the tenant because their unit did not exist anymore?
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. That's been debatable those last couple of weeks, or sorry, months. I've been working with some paralegals about. And some of the arguments that some investors make is that they're going to be gutting the entire building, like completely gutting the building to the studs and relocating the tenants somewhere else and redoing the layouts. Now, does that work? A lot of times the investors get cold feet, but we've gone to the point of doing that, the demolition permit, so we can demolish most of the unit layouts and starting from scratch. And we have those permits, and it's with the paralegal right now to see how they can work that out. Right. But the argument is that we're forcing them to leave, and we're changing up the unit layout, maybe adding one more den. So from a one bedroom they had, we're adding a den somehow. Because a lot of these units were massive in size before, so we can kind of fit in one little den. Now it's a one bedroom plus den. Do they have the right to come back? That's more of the paralegal to kind of let us know, but they're fairly confident. I spoke to three of them about the same sort of method, and they're fairly confident that it should work just because it's now returning back to the same original unit. Everything is brand new. But to get to that extreme of gutting down the entire, you know, building inside, that, again, some investors don't have the stomach for it, right?
Right. And I guess you have to also consider how much additional units you're adding. If you end up adding two additional units for an entire building, the LTV would be like, no, we're displacing 13 tenants for you to have two units in a building that's already in fairly good condition, right? So there's these like aspects that you can't always sort of account for that you need to keep in the back of your mind. What I'm interested in knowing, though, is you're saying, so like there's a two bedroom unit, there's a turnover, and then you chop it up into 2 1 bedrooms. What's the square footage print of these two? These have to be pretty massive two bedroom units, right?
Yeah. So they range, like, for that specific building, I think it was like 800 square feet. So we split off either like 400 and 400 or like 500 and 300 for a one bedroom and one bachelor, depending on the layout of the building, right? Sometimes it's a little bit awkward to get in 2 1 bedrooms at 400. So we got to do one bedroom at 500 and the bachelor unit at 300.
Very interesting. I've never heard anyone approach it that way. I guess sort of my curiosity is in terms of scope of work. So I know you mentioned that there's a lot of construction going on. You might have to go to other units. What other factors do you need to consider? Let's say that there's one unit that turns around. To get that unit into two units, how much work is going to be done going to like different tenants' units and having to do like electrical, plumbing, et cetera, et cetera? Like, how significant is that? Is that like a 6-7-8 month timeline or?
No. I think, and this is probably more for Taga to answer, but from my understanding, it was only going to take him about 3 months, 4 months, give or take, right? It just depends on the let's say, for example, we only have one unit to do all that common work, right? It wouldn't take that long to do that work, just running down all the pipelines and electrical systems and running it all back up to the unit itself, right? We just make one or two holes going all the way down. Versus if like the whole floor was vacant, right? We have four different units. We'd have to make like eight different holes all the way down. And that'd be a little bit more significant work there. And it would intrude and affect the common areas of these tenants. That is not just their unit, but the outside common hallways. We're going to be doing a lot more life safety checks because we also need to increase the fire alarm system. And that requires more work on the hallway side. So inside the unit, they're going to be disturbed. Outside the unit, they're going to be disturbed. So one way or another, it's going to be like they're not going to be able to escape the construction work being done. And again, I bring it up because we're not trying to make sure that we get them out right that way, but it turns out they can handle that for a few months. Everyone's tolerance is a little bit different.
Well, what was the cost to do that? Well, let's say you're going to just do two bedroom units, you convert it into four 1-bedroom units. What's the average cost of something like that?
Yeah. So I think we were looking, ballparking it around, that one was like 70,000, give or take, 70,000,
80,000. For a 2-unit, or is that for one?
For a 1-bedroom unit, per 1-bedroom unit was going to be about 70,000.
To take a two and make 2 1-beds cost about 70K.
Yeah, 140, give or take. Yeah. Yeah, that includes a lot of the common work as well, right? The way we do is like we divide up everything equally because we have to do the common work anyways for the hallways and electrical room and even the transformer. Because again, you can imagine like the 12 unit to 17 unit, that transformer on the city side wasn't built to hold that much capacity. So we had to upgrade that. And that's like an extra 50,000 right there.
Yeah.
It's not cheap. It's not cheap. Yeah, no, it's all these little things you have to kind of consider. Even the plumbing sizes, right? We had to increase the pipeline going from the building to the actual city side. I would say 8 out of 10 times, it should be fine. The 2 times that we had to do it, we had to increase it and excavate it. So there are elements there that are expensive, and that's part of the renovation costs.
Right. Okay. So you're basically increasing your rental income by, call it 1500, if you're adding 1-bed unit, right? Mm-hmm. Times 12. So that's about 18,000 a year in rental income. It's costing you, so is it costing you 70 or is it costing you 140 to do that?
It's probably going to cost us 140 at that point per unit.
To create it. Right. So yeah. 140. And so, but if you're increasing by 18,000 on a 6 cap, that's about a 300K lift in value. So then
The
math. Okay.
So the math works. Yeah. The math works at the end because we're looking at the cap rate in that area, right?
Yeah.
How much more money we're spending on construction versus what the value of the building is going to be. In some area, it's like the 5 cap rate. I think Hamilton was 5 cap rate, if I recall correctly, right?
Yep.
It just depends on which city you're investing in. This strategy might work really good and well in, but it might not work in a different city.
Right. And that so makes sense because it's very cap rate based. If you do this in Timmins, for example, your construction is still 70,000, but your rents are low, your cap rates are pretty high there. So like, it's just not going to work out mathematically. Mm-hmm. That being said, like I'm always sort of a due diligence guy. When you go in and you see a potential building that you want to implement this in, what type of due diligence are you doing to make sure like, hey, I can actually cut these into multiple units?
Yeah, it's great because we just did this a few days ago too with another investor. But the way we go about that, obviously number one is the zoning. But if the zoning checks out well, we're good on paperwork. Nothing in the city is really going to stop us like heritage and conservation. The next step is I'll go on site with my 3D scanner and then we'll scan the entire building. You know, we'll go out there, you know, the owners or the investors will go in there talking to the tenants and doing their own thing. Meanwhile, I'm going to be scanning their units inside out the entire building in like 20-30 minutes. And from that same day, I can develop some preliminary floor plans, get some rough measurements there and show them on paper. Listen, this is what the floor plan looks like. Here's what I'm thinking, how to split up the units, right? Based on this, we have maybe 900 square feet or 600 square feet, depending on what it is. I'll tell them, listen, if it's 900, we can split off into 2 units. If it's 600 and it's an awkward shape, I personally think we can't do this just because again, 300 bachelor units might not work well in this area. You also look into your tenant profile in that area. Does bachelors work or not, right? Or are you really just spending money just to add units? Because adding units as much as you want to may not always be the best choice, right? But that's how I usually approach that was in the same day, right? Giving them like actual floor plans, dimensions, very rough, granted, but at the same time, it's more than enough to show them and their investors that this makes sense.
Gotcha. And so that's interesting because I think Austin's head was probably going here as well. Like earlier, we had a conversation about another property that we owned And the opportunity was take, I guess, like a townhouse unit and make it into, I think it would have been 450 on the ground floor and like 350 upstairs because it's got like vaulted ceiling and stuff like that, right? And the advice, and this was in Windsor, the advice that we'd received from talking to some people was the square footage would be too small for the market, right? Like 350 units in Windsor just don't really exist. Some of the bachelor units there are still like 600 square feet, right? So I think it is very important that it is market specific, right? And some markets, you're actually seeing a pretty big delta between a one bedroom and a two bedroom to the point where it's like, hey, like what's my actual increase in NOI from doing this conversion once you factor in the separate hydro, separate meters, water lines, and everything else that kind of needs to be factored in there as well, right? So that's really interesting. So you guys moved in 2021 onto buying existing multifamily properties where you can increase densification wherever possible, right? Within the existing structure. How did you guys make that transition, right? Because that 5-unit building that you guys bought, and then now you're buying bigger multifamilies. Are you raising funds? Are you self-funding? Is it different partners on different assets? Like, how did you guys go about that?
Yeah, so we're definitely like part of different groups that are raising capital. Like, again, everyone has their own specialty, right? My specialty isn't really raising capital. Taco's specialty is construction. I'm specializing in the city officials and developments there. And we have a third partner sometimes to do all the random numbers, right? So it's usually a 3 or 4-man team. And again, these are different partners sometimes for different buildings. It depends on what they're looking for, right? But yeah, it's usually how we go about that. Again, like I'm not going to tell you I can run the numbers as good as some other people can do it perfectly. And they do it as a day-to-day job, right? So we usually work with people who are running the numbers. They come to us telling us, listen, I ran the numbers, preliminary, of course. I want to get your feedback on that. What can we do with this building? And does the construction cost like meet my budget to that? Or am I, you know, going out of the works? You know, maybe I can do 10 extra units, but my budget right now, because all the investments I raised can only do 5 units, right? That's a different conversation. And again, we can split off the application and start with the 5 units. And when they raise more capital, we can do the additional 5 units in that scenario, right? It just depends on what their limits are at that point. Everyone can raise different amount of money at that point.
Right, because this is more so like you're saying subcontracted by clients, you're saying, is when you're doing these like densification plays. Is that right?
Yeah, like some of them we own and some of them we're working with investors who are bringing the deal to us, right?
Okay, gotcha. Interesting. And so are these buildings, when you're going through densification, are you also going for MLI Select on the exit? What's the play there?
Yeah, 100%. We're always going through MLI Select program. And preferably, we always go with the energy efficiency, the affordability, and the accessibility doesn't really make sense to us, especially with the amount of money we spend for accessibility and affordability isn't really suited. We always go with energy efficiency. Like we're trying to get out all the gas systems in there and put in like the heat pump systems, any of the electrical there to heat up the units. And that's how we've been trying to get away with, like, well, not get away, but trying to make use of that exit route, right?
Okay. Are you seeing that it's becoming more difficult to hit the energy efficiency requirements for 100 points? Or have you guys seen much movement on that or not really?
I think it's more of a debate at that point. Like we have to analyze, like we'll get the energy auditors out there to tell us 100% of what we need to do. Yeah. But there's some people that tell us we need to put like 3 heat pumps in a 2-bedroom unit versus you can do 1 heat pump and 2 electric baseboards and still hit the 100 points. Right. Now that strategy could save you thousands of dollars instead of doing 3 different mini splits of heat pumps, right? Now you can just spend maybe half the cost on just doing 1 heat pump for the living and dining room and like 2 electric baseboards for the bedrooms. Right? And we still hit the 100 points regardless, right? But some energy auditors are like, no, you have to get 3 heat pumps. So it's debatable at that point. So we kind of look into it a little bit further with our own engineering.
So are you getting multiple energy auditors to go in then in that case? Are you getting like multiple recommendations before finalizing on which one? Or is it one you work with regularly again and again?
We work with one regularly and then we get our engineer to kind of triple check, like, does this make sense? Or, you know, what about the cost of that as well? Right. So we're always like, again, you trust, but you want to verify information.
Right. We do want to get into one of the projects that you're working on now. So could you, let's chat about, I don't know if there's any projects that are exciting to you that we can dive into.
Yeah. So let's say, I think the most exciting thing right now that I'm working on is a church conversion, right? Well, that and like the 15 to 31 unit development I'm working on right now. So don't know how much time we have left, but I think for people to kind of understand the level that we're at, we're working on church conversions. Yeah. So this church conversion, the idea is basically it's a church and a gym put together, and we're trying to fit in as many units as we can, trying to reflect the amount of students in this area, trying to rent them out to them. And I think we finalized design, what was it, last week, give or take. So we ended off with about 28 units, 90 bedrooms is what we're at. This is like a massive, like 20,000 square foot church gym area. So we're splitting off the, again, the church is like so high up. We're adding like that new floor system, two of them actually for three stories. We're adding another floor to the gym. We're trying to make sure we're working within the show, but maybe one little addition to it, just so we can hit that number of like trying to hit 100 bedrooms, but we couldn't just because of the space laid out. But I'm pretty proud to say that we got that many in there.
How do you even begin with renovation cost on converting a church to over 20 units and 90 beds?
Yeah. And this is where, like, thank God for like Taco being in my back pocket too. Like, he's a big help for me understand the construction costs, but you never really know what a construction cost is going to be until you finalize for permits. But at the ballpark, we were looking at like 100, 120 per unit. These are fairly small too, so they weren't going to be as big. That being said, some of them were very awkward in like five bedrooms, one living room. Again, trying to treat for more of the student housing there. It's not really a student rental, but more of like a massive apartment units like that. But yeah, we were budgeting 100, 120,000 for that renovation process.
So 30 units per unit should be about roughly 4.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So church conversions was a big thing. I feel like ever since 2020, I feel like I'm hearing more and more about people just buying churches and trying to convert them into residential apartment buildings. What are the things that you think people don't hear about? That's the first thing, right? Like with a church, cool to look at, got a big shell. I don't know. I don't even know where to start. Right.
Yeah.
So what do you guys do from inception? You see a church, they're asking, let's just say $1 million, not unheard of for the square footage in a lot of major markets, right? Where do you go from there?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Cause even for us, we're just like, how do we evaluate this type of building? And we go back to our own templates, our own systems about how we evaluate other buildings. We treat it like it's an empty apartment building. For example, obviously there's no income to this building.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're trying to see how do we maximize that, or how do we get that sort of like loan to actually buy this building? That's another struggle itself. But if the financials are kind of clear that way, we look at what's there with the building right now was a church, right? The heating systems are all electrical baseboards majority of the time. You'll see on the edge of the buildings are all electric baseboards. So we're going to change that, of course, right? The height is so extremely high. We can always add at least one more floor to it. In our case, we were able to add two floors to it.
What does it cost to add a floor, generally speaking?
Sorry, like cost to generally add in a new floor?
Yeah, in an existing shell.
Mm-hmm. I would say I'm going
to ballpark. What's the scope of work to begin with to even
add a new floor? No, there's a bunch of information. We can talk about this all night, but just to simplify it too, it's like the process about that is like trying to understand, number one, the height, how many floors we can add in, and then from there, the structural integrity of the building. Like these churches are built to be like three layers of brick sometimes. So is a brick able to support the new beams to build that new floor? And then dig it all the way down so the basement would have like 20 new posts to help support these new floors. That's another restriction, because now we add a bunch of posts in the basement that limits us on adding more units to the basement. So now it's like you get more floors, but you lose one floor. It's like the sacrifice. So we have to be very careful in how we're designing and laying that out, right? But that's how our process works. Again, I when I go to a building, I kind of like visualize it myself, trying to see like what we can do with the building. And again, explain to you guys the same way I would explain to them, this is how I would do it, but here are the risks doing that. One of the biggest risks, of course, was working with church. And just for your audience to know too, is like the heritage value of these churches. Can't really get rid of anything of the church outside. Heritage really doesn't want you to mess around with that. So thankfully, a lot of the churches that I've seen so far, is they have massive windows, so we don't really have to pop out any holes for new windows. But sometimes the way the churches are built, they're bigger on the base, and as you go up, it gets shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
So now if we add more floors to it, our second floor will be smaller than our first floor. So now we might not be able to add many units to that level, right? And so on with the third floor. So all these little things we have to kind of keep in mind there. But again, like the way I do it, and the same way I would do it in my due diligence, is like I scan the building, scan the church, do a preliminary floor plan same day, and just show them, listen, this is what the square footage is, and this is what I think we can do. Of course, nothing's in concrete, because again, the church is a very complex project, right? But at least it gives them a high level information of like how many units we can add, and is it worth the construction amount that we're going to be spending?
Gotcha. It seems basically like there's really no rule of thumb when it comes to church conversions, right? It's probably something for someone with a little bit more of a structural engineering background or a little bit more of a deeper construction knowledge, which is fair. And that's why we always stayed away from them as well, right?
Well, as long as you understand the principles, like the same principles we would take for multifamily, we check the plumbing, we check the electrical, we check the structural, we check everything as we would have for multi, we bring it to the church conversion, right? Yeah, of course, a building, a multifamily building was always built to have 6, 8, 10 units. So it has a different infrastructure versus a church that was only built to have like an open space for just like maybe 100 people to be in, right? So you have to kind of evaluate both systems and see if we have to change the entire electrical system, how much is that going to be? Have to increase the water line because the water line for a church is much smaller than the one for an apartment building. So there's more cost to that than a normal apartment building and just trying to add like 4 or 5 units to it.
Interesting.
On the church side of things, so you mentioned its heritage status. Like churches, I'm Googling how most of them look like. There's not a ton. Like, are the windows are oddly shaped, right? Like the big U shape. Are you able to add windows? Or are they going to tell you not to touch the exterior at all?
They've politely told me not to touch any of the windows, even the window glass itself. You know, like you'll see the churches with that specific glass.
Yeah.
They really don't want us to even touch that, right?
Okay.
So it's like, okay. So then, and you'll probably see in some of the pictures that you're looking at right now, some of these windows extend so high up. If you're adding a floor and it's going to be in between the window, how do you work that out
by
separation?
Yeah.
Right. So we're working with some engineers on that to kind of resolve that without damage in the window, but we might have to negotiate with Heritage to say, listen, we're not going to demolish the window, but we're going to maybe have to alter this one little part where the floors intersect with that window.
Right.
Right. There has to be some compromise.
Is this done in the due diligence phase, or do you usually do this after you have it under contract?
We usually do it after we have it under contract, because with the Heritage guys involved, it's going to be like weeks before we even get a clear answer. And for them to properly assess the condition of the building, they would want a site visit and they would want the drawings to show what's there and what you're proposing.
And it's firm, or you have like conditions, and how does that work?
We have conditions. Like before we go firm, we have conditions. Like let's say, you know, I'm not going to say 2 weeks, about 30 days to kind of do our due diligence and get some response back from the city. Granted, again, different cities have different turnaround timelines. The Heritage guys have been pretty quick. Within 2 weeks, they'll get back to us. But at the same time, you have to budget time in for the drawings. Like for my team to do a proper drawing, it'd be like 2 or 3 weeks. Then we're going to need 2 more weeks for the Heritage guys to review it and get on site. So already it's about 5 weeks, right?
Right.
Before we even get a clear answer. So I'm telling like investors for these bigger projects, kind of extend your closing date or even before you get firm, extend as much as you can so we can get some proper answers.
Okay.
It does seem like ultimately with development, you've got to be a little bit comfortable with the unknown, right? Like it sounds like there's a lot of shit that like pops up as you go along that no matter what you do, you never really got to fully know it, right? Like you're construction budget is like, oh, it could be $3 million, it could be $5 million. I think that's what I'm kind of imagining, right?
Yeah, no, it's always going to be that way. But it's safer to do multifamily because of multifamily, a lot of people are more familiar with church conversions. Like, how many people are really doing church conversions right now? Like, not as many as multifamilies, right? So, numbers are going to be all over the place,
right? Yeah, no, that's fair. So, on that topic, are you able to share the numbers on the church building? I have no idea if
probably not right now, but definitely if we do something like this next year, then we can definitely kind of revisit those numbers because that's where I'm predicting we'll probably have permits and be in construction phase.
Gotcha. Okay. No, I think that's great. I think, you know, we covered a lot. I know we went a little bit of tangent with the site plan approvals and the permits, but I still think we managed to cover, and that was really good as well. I think it's something that a lot of people just don't understand what are the differences, and we covered what this church conversion process is and the densification as well. So with that being said, Henry, so at this point in the podcast, we usually like to ask our guests 2 questions. One is for someone that's looking to get into this space, call it multifamily like construction or development, right? Because you're kind of somewhere in between that. You're not necessarily ground up developing, but you are adding densification, which is more than like a cosmetic renovation that some multifamily investors do. Mm-hmm. What's like one piece of advice that you leave them with, or one kind of risk that you tell them to be cautious of, or so on?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I would tell them is be wary of the tenants, because they're always asking questions. They're always trying to find out what's going on with the building, especially when we're, again, in our due diligence phase. I've been involved in so many site visits that once I get in there with a scanner, they start asking very high-level questions on what's going on, why are you scanning the units, why are you scanning the buildings, and they start pressing you with all these stuff. Now, again, a lot of investors are very experienced in how to deal with that, but as a starter or mid-level investor and you're trying to get into that space, just be cautious of these tenants. Like, obviously, some of them build their own communities in the buildings, and they'll be wary of that whole situation and might give you a harder time. Or in that transition where we're trying to buy a building and they already don't like us, it could already, it might cause problems down the road, right? So my advice there is just like, you know, try and make sure you keep the tenants in the unknown as much as possible. Try to keep them a little bit happy until we've done the scan properly and done our due diligence as best we can within one or two site visits. And then we can start doing the permit work process a little bit more easier and start construction a little bit better than if they had known something and planned something beforehand.
Right. That's solid advice. Second question for you is, you know, how do you see your business evolving the next 2 to 3 years? Right. And you can answer this from the investing side. You can answer this in terms of the types of projects you do, whatever whatever you feel fit.
Yeah, 100%. So I think from the investment side, we are looking to buy more like higher level buildings. And what I mean by that is like more units. Right now, we're playing around with like probably the 10 to 30 unit numbers. And hopefully in the next 5 years or so, we're trying to buy maybe 50 plus apartment buildings. Now, when you get into that level of apartment buildings, there is a little bit of a barrier there. A lot of similar stuff, but there are some key elements with bigger buildings that have their own struggles. So we are looking to get into that space. And luckily, Falco and I have done that before. We actually worked on some higher level apartment buildings in the past that we're familiar with. So it won't be too much of a learning curve there. It's just getting back to our roots under our own umbrella versus like working for an investor. It'll be our own properties.
Awesome. Really appreciate your time here, Henry. We definitely learned a lot, and it's pretty cool to see people implementing different strategies on their own portfolio. Originally, I was always thinking about like people doing additions, people adding basement units, but never really thought about chopping up existing units. So definitely a lot of value that you added there. If people want to work with you, maybe invest with you, possibly just chat more with you, how could they best do so?
Yeah, the best method to do so is like reaching me on Instagram at Rojas Empire. I'm always on Instagram. I'm always trying to share as much information there. I do some lives there too, just show what we're working on. At the end of the day, I'm not trying to show off our work, but trying to tell or advise investors like what we're doing and what's possible. Because some people don't go to networking events, so they don't know what's possible out there. So they rely on social media to kind of learn that. And that's where we kind of come in.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Not everyone shows up to every networking event. Not everyone's like you. So wherever you can add value, that's a good way to do so. If you guys enjoy this episode, make sure to leave us with a like, a follow, give Henry a follow, give Henry a shout out as well. Share this with a friend. It helps bring great guests like Henry on. And until next time, everyone, invest smarter and live better. Take care, all.